Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace. Thanks again, Chef. Appreciate you coming on. For full transparency, this is take two again. So this is the second time that I've done this. The first time was in the studio and we somehow the audio into the audio recorder was all jacked up. This time we forgot to turn the I forgot to hit make sure that it said audio and video. So we're going round two. I'm super excited because I got to get the good firsthand on the last conversation. But with me today is Chef Dustin Salvaggio. He is, let me go down the list, husband, father, chef, director of innovation for Waring, owner, chief culinary guru at Mies Concepts. He's an adjunct professor for Drexel University, a graduate of Johnson & Wales, on and on and on and on. You've got the credentials, you've got the chops, and I cannot wait to get into it. Let's just maybe start with Waring, and then we'll take it from there. But maybe... who is Waring? What do they do? And then kind of your role as the director of innovation at Waring.
Sure. So Waring Commercial Products, we are a brand of kitchen equipment that is, I would like to say, all encompassing. Like, we have a piece for every product line that you could think of. We have induction lines, we have blenders. So basically a tool to meet every need in the industry. We've been around since the 30s. We actually invented the blender. Mr. Fred Waring himself patented and invented the blender in the late 30s. And it's been revolutionizing how we cook since. Based on that kind of theme of innovation, we've been pushing the boundaries a little bit lately, which is crazy. We're getting into fermentation. We're getting into power blending. We're experimenting with some other technologies that might come out in the future. So it's an exciting time. And, you know, that's kind of leads me to, you know, what I do every day as a director of innovation is I work with the marketing and product development teams and our engineers to make sure that, you know, our tools are the best they can possibly be, that they're meeting the needs of the chefs, that they're as durable as we say they are, and that we're, you know, thinking of the future and, you know, some of those pitfalls and problems that chefs experience day to day and solving that with technology, you know, where we can, or even with just information and education in some of our marketing initiatives. So it's really exciting role. Never thought I'd be here, to be honest with you. I thought I'd die on the line eating a piece of foie gras, right?
So. I think a lot of us do. And if you're lucky enough, I don't want to leave it in a negative connotation, but I feel like if you're lucky enough to kind of find some of these positions that they're out there, there's a lot of them. You can find your way. There's more than just fine dining, being on the line. Don't get me wrong. Mm-hmm. It's got its benefits. And we'll go into some of that background in a little bit. But at the end of the day, depending on the life that you want to lead, again, you want James Beard Awards? Awesome. Go for it. I pat you on the back. We need those people. But when you start a family, sometimes it's not all glitz and glam, and you hear about the burnout. You hear about the mental distress that chefs get put on them. But not to stray too far off the path here with Waring, you know, what's your experience as a chef kind of helped you with your approach with this, with product innovation and how you work with those teams?
Yeah, I mean, really, I was just always a chef that, you know, questioned everything. And I wanted to know why certain cooking processes worked or why certain ingredients tasted better than others. So early on in my career, I kind of went down that path of trying to answer questions to the problems that I didn't really feel like we're being answered in the industry, you know, like making risotto. You know, when I was growing up, it was, I've heard everything from it's the spoon, it's the amount of times you stir it, it's the type of rice, it's this. And all of those have a little bit of, you know, impact on it. But at the end of the day, it's not really the physics, the science, the biochemistry that's making that risotto creamy. And, you know, those are the things that I sought out on my own to learn. And, you know, when I was starting out, I was in that early phase of the modernist movement where there was still a lot of the old guard trying to keep it from happening because they felt that a better understanding of what was going on in the cooking process would kill the passion of the cooking process, if that makes sense. They kind of thought like the understanding of low temperature cooking and sous vide or you know, introducing methods like that would take away from the recipe, whereas, you know, I saw it as why spend 15 years or 5 years or however long it may take you to learn how to roast and cook meats perfectly and throw all of those meats away or ruin all those pieces of meat when, you know, you can understand and appreciate how to do that. But then for your operation, you know, automate it with something like sous vide technology or a combi oven or yeah, I don't look at it as a detriment if you're understanding where it came from and you're understanding where that technology fits in. By no means do I feel that, you know, chefs should adopt sous vide right out of the gate or any of these technologies right out of the gate. I do firmly feel that a chef, to be a chef and run a kitchen and create a menu that conveys them on the plate or their teams, you know, on the plate, you'd have to go through the tradition of cooking. You have to hold that knife and learn how to make the cuts. Mm-hmm. You have to learn how to sear a piece of meat and grill a piece of meat to temperature, because all of these technologies will help you be consistent and help you maintain a higher level of food. But if you don't know how to fix it in a classic way or without the expensive tools, you're dead in the water when that circulator goes down. You don't know how to cook at that point. And that's where I feel the problem kind of can lie. But I'm really happy to see that for the most part, chefs have done what I feel they should do. And that's, you know, they've learned the tradition. They learned the classic way of cooking and the, you know, the knife cuts, the sears, the braises, and then they adopt the equipment to kind of make it better. So, you know, the long answer to your question is, I went down the analytical science path, and that helped me kind of take problems in the industry and pick them and dissect them apart, which aids me a lot in my job now of, okay, well, we have a problem of higher labor in the industry or unskilled labor in the industry. What tools do we have that we can make better to meet that? Or what tools can we develop to meet those needs? And without that analytical kind of understanding of cooking and food science and process, I don't know if I'd be a good fit for this role, right? Because it helps me put those pieces together and work with those disciplines, you know?
Yeah, the why is what you're getting at. To understand, mm-hmm. I by no means have the kind of background that you do. You know, I went to school, but I think it has its time and its place, and it gives you certain tools for your toolbox, but you have to experience the real world. And I was more into production cooking. So I was used to feeding not as many a la carte plates, but it's how do you feed 5,000 kids a day, you know, at still a high quality with those basics. And like you said, if you're not understanding the why behind what you're doing, when things happen, you can't correct it on the fly. It's not that kind of the second nature or subconscious thinking that just takes over because you've done it, you've been in it, you've been through the fire, and I've tried that. I know that doesn't work, and they're trying to do it. No, we need to pivot. So understanding the why behind it is critically, I agree with you, critically important to, I think, any position in this industry. I think if you try and just jump in, it's going to be a lot tougher to just be very, very good at what you do. So how do you stay informed with all the different technologies that might influence future products, right? There's where we've been and where we're going. And obviously we also have to tailor to where we're going. So where do you kind of get that information?
I'm fortunate enough that in my career, I've been able to work in a couple really high-end kitchens, and I've built a network of really exceptional chefs. These guys turn me on to some of the new techniques that are going on out there. And then I go on kind of a quest through the equipment channels to see, is anybody really developing this or working on something like this? There's also the trade shows, right? We have a few international trade shows every year, a couple in Asia. The biggest one for the Western Hemisphere is Host in Italy every other year, just had in October. These are all great places that I dive into, but admittedly, I'm a food geek and I read white papers a lot. And white papers are where you get like the real cutting edge of what technology is possible or what technology is being kind of explored and opened up so that you can kind of keep your finger on the pulse of what may be coming down the pike. But a lot of it, to be honest with you, the things that we kind of target and focus on the most is the feedback from the industry and what the chefs are in unison saying they're seeing and using, or they're asking questions about. Maybe they haven't used it and they know that we're, you know, equipment specialists. So they come to us and say, have you seen this? What does it do? Do you know anything about it? Once you get a few of those kind of buzz things through the network that you're dealing with, it kind of leads you in the right direction of, you know, where should we be looking for the next tool, right? What's going to be the most beneficial for the business? What do they want?
Yeah, for sure. Any dream innovations for kitchen equipment? Maybe this leads into the fermentation unit, because when we talked the first time, I could feel the passion, the energy on some of these topics. So maybe we can talk. I do want to talk about this fermentation unit and just as a
generality. Actually wearing a shirt.
Very nice. But is there any other innovations that you would be excited to help develop or see in the future?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I'm not really at, liberty to say, because they are behind the scenes in development. And I have a couple of dreams in the works right now that will revolutionize the redundancies that we experience day to day in the business. But I've already seen a couple of these dreams come to fruition. One is the recent launch of our Ellipse blender, it's called. It's a dual motor blender that drives from the top and the bottom at the same time. So it, takes blending to a whole new level, right? Like you can do nut butters in 45 seconds without any fat added to it. Wow. You can do smoothie acai bowls in 10 seconds, like soup purees, 5-6 seconds. And it's super creamy and smooth too. So there's lots of dreams coming down the pike and there's lots of innovations out there. But, to your point earlier, I think the biggest dream come true so far is the pod, which is a fermentation oven that we're going to be releasing at the end of this year. We're actually doing sneak peeks at NRA, so everybody should stop by the booth if you're going to be there. But it's the most revolutionary tool that's going to hit the kitchen since sous vide. We all know fermentation is a very strong part of most scratch kitchens, and even, beyond scratch kitchens, production kitchens are starting to get into fermentation. The benefits it has for flavor, for nutrition, and for sustainability, outweigh any of the complications that come along with it. But we've tried to kind of streamline that process and make fermentation easy to anybody that wants to get into it with this oven. So, pretty exciting time, to be honest with you. But yeah, that to me is the dream.
And so is fermentation, again, this is not my area of expertise, but is it called koji, or is koji a type of fermentation?
Yeah, koji is a form of fermentation. So when I speak about fermentation and when you hear about fermentation in food nowadays, it's a term that refers to a technique that encompasses a lot of different things, right? It could be making misos or koji or growing tempeh, or it could be making pickles and, kimchi and like things like that, or, wines and chocolates even. Like fermentation's in a lot of things that most people don't realize. But essentially what fermentation is it's the microbes that live in the world around us. It's the ability to control and maintain them so that they process your food product into something different, right? So that's kind of the easiest way I can describe it. And a good fermenter is somebody who understands those variables that the individual microbes like, and they provide those variables and those favorable conditions to the microbes that they're trying to grow and propagate. And then that's how you get fermentation, right? We limit the bad stuff. We give the good stuff to the good germs and microbes, and then they do all the work. And it's magical.
Kind of, I don't want to say the same vein, but like dry aging, right? You're letting a product go for a period of time. It's going through different chemical reactions, moisture is evaporating, it's developing, it's creating a completely different flavor, to be honest, but it's just in a different method or application per se. But I'm just trying to make people understand what it is, because it's like, why would I ever ferment something or do anything? And it's all about the development of flavors. I think most of us that get into this, it's all about the development of flavors. As simple as soups. The good soups are always the ones that have time to develop and build those flavors over time, or a good sauce. It's not done in a day. They're done in two, as you know. They may take a long period of time constantly reducing, but you're just building a layer of flavor on top of each other. That's so cool. So I'm excited to see it in NRA. If somebody wants to know more about fermentation, I think you've got a resource on that. What would be a good resource for people?
Yeah, you can come check us out at the website. I mean, we have a lot of tools popping up day by day on fermentation. But I mean, if you really want to get into fermentation, get a good crash course on it, the Noma Guide to Fermentation really is excellent. It's going to give you all of the, like a broad view of what fermentation is in the modern food world. And it also really brings it down to a layman's level. If you're a beginner and a novice fermenter, you can pick up this book and jump into it pretty easily. And then also I would say Koji Alchemy would be another great book if you're looking to get into the Koji end of fermenting, which in my experience, a lot of the chefs nowadays, Koji is the kind of ferment they're going for because of the applications and the limitless, you know, possibilities that it opens up to the chef. It becomes like it's an ingredient that's more so a tool than an actual ingredient, right? If you use it right, you can manipulate so many different foods into something special or something completely different than what you're expecting. So I think Koji is like going to be probably the biggest, I hate using the word trend, but like the biggest thing to hit the food scene since sous vide and microwaving, you know, like there's not been another ingredient or something that's come along that's, to me, so revolutionary, right?
Because it feels like amazing. Not everything's been done, but most everything has been done, or everyone has played with trying to fuse this, do that, come out with something new. It's just really difficult to come out with something that's really, like you said, revolutionizing or could change a kitchen completely. Mm-hmm. And talking about changing, I think people need to know about this miracle berry that is out there. So maybe let's go into this miracle berry, because looking on Amazon when we were talking about it, and I was like, I've got to get some of these. So what is a miracle berry, and why would one
use it? So there's actually a famous chef, Amaro Cantu, who kind of pioneered this back in like the early 2000s at his restaurant Modo. The miracle berry is a berry that grows naturally, that when you ingest it, it alters the flavors on your tongue. So like it'll flip like sour and sweet, or, you know, spicy and salty, or whatever it may be. So for instance, you could take a shot of sriracha hot sauce and get zero heat on your palate, but taste all of like the garlic and the nuances of the sriracha. And, you know, a lemon wedge, for instance, something as simple and mundane as a lemon wedge, you know what that's like when you bite into a lemon wedge and that puckering feeling when you bite into a lemon wedge with a miracle berry. It's like biting into a lemon drop candy. It's super sweet.
Insane.
Yeah. So it's wild. And, you know, when I had my restaurant, we put a little too much time into developing a menu where it was the same menu in two sets. And that was going to be like the, can I curse on here? Almost dropped the F-bomb. Yeah. All right. So it's supposed to be the mind fuck, right? Like you serve people this, five courses, little bites, and then they do a little intermezzo and then flip it around and give them the same five courses, but that intermezzo was the miracle berry.
That would be
so
insane.
When they eat the same menu, they're like, what the hell's going on? I just had this. And when they eat it, it tastes completely different. We tried it. The problem is A, the miracle berry affects people and is perceivable at different time rates. And I don't know what that time rate is, because out of the kitchen staff that we tested, everybody had a slightly different, you know, time to when they could feel it. And the other is the intensity and the effect of it. So I noticed, like with, I told you, with the lemon wedge, especially, that was like the most surprising to me. That lemon wedge to me was like super sweet, where my other sous chef was telling me it was very floral to him and it still had sour notes. So everybody kind of, I don't know if it's like a perception thing, you know, like sometimes flavors can trigger nostalgia, which affects the perception of the flavor. Maybe that plays into it, or it could be, you know, a physical thing. Yeah, I don't know, but I didn't really do enough research or time with it. Regardless, at the end of the day, it's a really cool thing to play around with your friends and family. Get your hands on it. And it's one of those cool food things that most people don't know about, but it's fun, right? It's something that anybody who does it can enjoy it. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So you've mentioned having a restaurant. People are probably like, hey, what's this guy's background? Let's maybe give a synopsis. I think it sets the stage too for some of the conversation we're having of your depth of knowledge to some of these subjects and topics. So maybe just kind of give a brief overview of that.
Sure. Started out like most chefs in the kitchen of my grandparents. I was fortunate enough to grow up in a family that raised a lot of their own crops and food. We didn't live on a farm, but, you know, we had like sort of a Liberty Garden, if you will, at all of the different family locations. So grandparents, aunts, uncles, and we all kind of traded, and our family really celebrated food growing up. You know, it was obviously how we came together, but we all respected it and appreciated it, me more than a lot of the others in my family. So that kind of became a theme throughout my life in early years was when things got tough or things were bothering me, I'd jump into the kitchen and cook something and I would always feel better, or I'd make breakfast for my family and it would like make the day awesome. Right. Or even if I was just like bored and I wanted to do something, I always went to the kitchen. So it was natural that I ended up in this career. And I started out like everybody else, you know. Actually, first started out, I was a fast food cook, my first professional job. I was slinging chili dogs at a local hot dog spot here in Pennsylvania. And it was awesome. It taught me, you know, people look down on that. Some chefs that are starting out, like, oh, I'll never do that. To me, it taught me speed and it taught me memory. I noticed that from that job, when I did jump into the kitchens and got past the dishwashing phase into cooking, I can navigate a saute station and a pantry station faster than some of the people that have been doing a couple of years, because I had the memory skills and the organization from the fast food experience. So went into fine dining, and I worked at a local restaurant where the chef was doing farm to table, like back in the late 80s. He was one of the first, you know, that chefs in our area that you heard doing it. And I fell in love with that. I found purpose in that. Because to me, it was just, it reminded me of my youth of eating really fresh products off the vine and, you know, right out of the garden. And up until then, in a professional setting, I hadn't experienced quality of product like that. So I jumped into farm to table and really set my sights from there on out on the fine dining, you know, gambit. And I worked at Disney for a bit, did my externship there, and then, you know, worked after that, stayed on for a bit with Disney. And then I did what most chefs do. I bounced around for a few years, learning as much as I could from every chef I could, until it led me to some research jobs where I would develop menus and recipes and processes for different operations, whether corporations or not. And yeah, it came full circle to me owning a restaurant. And the restaurant was a bistro during the day. So we did crepes and tartines and coffee and nothing wild, right? It was like pastries, anything you would get if you went to like a Parisian cafe. But then at night we flipped it and we did like this ultra modern French interpretation of food. I don't even want to call it French cuisine. And we were doing all kinds of wild. So I had a rotovap in the front of my kitchen where people would come and like stay. They even wrote up a little article in our local paper, you know, saying it was like Breaking Bad and he's making drugs in there. And what is, it's like, guys, come on. Like, just cause you don't understand something, come, you know, come learn a little bit and learn.
Yeah.
But yeah, we had a lot of fun there, and that my restaurant taught me a lot about myself, right? As a chef and also as a person, right? Because when you go through this career of working in these fine dining establishments and you're always pushing yourself, you don't know how to turn it off at a certain point. And the restaurant was what taught me that about myself. And I say this because there's a lot of chefs out there probably in the same situation. They're just grinding every day, doing the best they can, sacrificing everything they have for their passion and cooking this food for people. Yeah. But it's important that we take a break and we focus on ourselves and our teams as individuals and not just tools to make food. Because I left my restaurant and sold my interest in it because I didn't like who I had become, being so obsessive about perfection and pushing forward so hard. So that's where it jumped into like the whole tool and technology realm. Is I stepped out of the kitchens and I went into, okay, well, I've learned all of this about all these crazy tools out there and how to use them in an operation. It's time to share my knowledge. So that's where I started working with the equipment brands and consulting, and brought me here today. Now I'm the director of innovation for a global brand that makes amazing equipment. And I never thought I would have been here, right? It was all just putting my head down, working hard, and always asking why, right? I'll keep coming back to that, because I think in my career, that's the most pivotal quality, right? The fact that I always ask why has led me to where I am. If I was complacent, I probably wouldn't have had the experiences and, you know, the knowledge that I do have now, which is, you know, I'm very thankful for. But to all the chefs out there, don't push too hard, guys. You have friends and family that love you. You should love you. Like, you know, food is food and it's great to share your passion and push it on the plate. But when it gets to that point where you don't realize what anything else in life is anymore and it's just about that next plate going out, start reevaluating how you can do it a little bit differently, because there's somebody in your life, maybe it's not you, but somebody in your life is suffering from that. So
for sure.
Yeah.
Yep. Do you ever miss it? You ever miss getting your ass kicked on a Friday night?
Of course. I miss it all the time.
That camaraderie, the whole thing. And then,
yes.
And then you're like, maybe like once a year to try. And you're like, no, the other side.
I still wet my whistle with pop-up dinners I do with friends, okay. And I do some collaboration events, and I get to cook at like events and product testing and videos and stuff. So I get the cooking part of it still, because I don't know if I could live without being able to cook in my job, but I do miss the camaraderie. I have camaraderie with a group of chefs around the globe, but it's not the same as being there next to them every day. And like those moments when you're working a busy service and you're not saying a word to each other, but you know where each other are.
Yeah.
There's nothing like that. There's nothing like that in the world. It's, and I think that's weird, what we get addicted to.
That line cook telepathy that you just know when somebody's getting ready to walk behind you, even though they may say behind or corner, you just know what the next movement is. It's the weirdest subconscious. Especially when you've been in those kitchens with those folks for potentially years, it's second nature. It's super, super cool. So you mentioned – you mentioned Breaking Bad and a lab. And so a little bird or someone told me that maybe you had a secret food lab in Brooklyn of some sort. I don't know what this secret lab is or what it's all about, or if you can even talk about it. But I figured
I consult. I have a company called Mies Concepts where I get involved in operational consulting for different food service operations, whether it's a grocery store, restaurant, or whatever. Think like kitchen nightmares, but luckily for me, I'm not going in when the machine's broken a lot of times. I'm just going in to kind of tighten things up. Because usually when the machine's broken, it just ends up arguing with an owner, and then, you know, everybody's unhappy at the end of the day anyway. So, I had done this kosher grocery store in Brooklyn. I am not Jewish or kosher, so I had to learn an entire religious law associated with food and produce the most food I've ever been involved in producing in my life. It was astronomical, the volume of food that went through that place in a day. But it was fun. It was awesome. And in order to do it properly, I had to build a full-blown food lab. We had rotovaps, salinity meters, water meters, water activity meters. I had a whole fermentation room. I had fermentation cabinets for Koji. All in all, I think the lab cost us like close to $1 million. It was like $700,000. But if you costed it out at the end of the day, the amount we would have to pay to bring that stuff into the business, along with the testing that went on, that we could do on site that we would have to send off, it pays for itself in like 2 years, 3 years. Because the amount of testing for our shelf stable products alone, like every batch of salami we would make or beef jerky, it all has to go to a lab and get tested and certified. Well, we could do that in house. And then we would just send it off for verification, right?
Yeah, so it's not even just the testing getting sent, but the time to send get results, get back, and then make edits, adjustments. Mm-hmm. If there needs to be one, then resend it out. It's just, we can make the adjustment and go.
It was awesome.
That's kind of cool. It's like, straight up Breaking Bad for food. Amazing. Yeah. You also, what do you do with Drexel? I know you're an adjunct professor. What do you do at the university?
So I teach the modern tools and techniques course that the students have right before they graduate. So I'm dealing with all the seniors and juniors for the most part. And really I just mold minds. I try to give them the heads up that I wish I would have had at their age. And it's one of the most rewarding things I do, to be honest with you. I love teaching at Drexel, meeting the new generation and seeing how chefs are changing before my eyes. Like I've been doing it for about 7 years, and I was just saying this the other day to a colleague. The students I had the first year I was teaching versus the students I had this last semester, it's night and day. I mean, the kids that are coming into this field are changing rapidly. And I mean, very fast. And it's faster than I anticipated. You know, being kind of at the forward cusp of a lot of these modern tools and movements and stuff, I thought, I had my finger on the pulse and that the industry was going to change, but it was going to be gradual. I don't think it's going to be as gradual as we think anymore. These kids coming into it, they want everything automated. They want everything through touch screens. They're extremely intelligent. They're extremely fast at gathering information as well. So in a kitchen where the chef goes, it's the spoon and you stir it 50 times, it doesn't work anymore, right? That mentality of cook is gone. So it's really cool to see, you know, being a professor, you get to see these things and this trend and movement and just youth and how they're changing. So the future is bright. I think that we lost a lot of good people with COVID. You know, we lost a lot of trained chefs who were excellent at what they did. They just never came back.
Yeah.
And we have like this lull now in labor where there's only a few guys left or girls left that can, you know, produce and do the things that we were accustomed to chefs doing. And a lot of the people left, leaving like a lot of green people, right? So now you have this limbo where I think everybody is experiencing when they go out to eat. The food's not as good as it used to be, even at the best restaurants. The service is really not that great. The prices are through the roof. And all of this, yeah, this is all because of these factors that COVID caused. And I don't think people realize the restaurant that you went to pre-COVID that you loved and you got the same whatever, chicken marsala, whatever you went there for every week, and now it's different, it's not their fault. It's the fault of COVID, right? We had an industry where every chef was just grinding and grinding and grinding and showing up to work every day, pushing the boundary, and all of a sudden it stopped. And all of those people that were pushing and pushing and pushing and ignoring all of those pressures that I talked about earlier, they realize, oh, wow, these pressures are here and this is crazy. Why am I doing this? And, oh, there's no work. When is there going to be work again? And the whole restaurant world shut down. So unfortunately, you know, a lot of people left. But, you know, this new generation of cooks that are coming in to supplant that old generation, I think are going to revolutionize how we eat as a country. You know, in America especially, we're going to see rapid changes in the food scene in the next 5 to 10 years.
What kind of time frame were you were thinking with them getting in? And
I would say 5 years, you're going to start seeing a new movement of food. Like we've seen things get simpler, and I think things are going to get a little bit more complicated, but more refined, and everything that can be automated will be automated. I don't see the kids of the new kitchens rocking a knife as much as we used to. I see them wanting to use a food processor more, and they don't like the waste of time.
Yeah. No, there's so many tools in the kitchen to, like you said, be more productive, speed things up. I agree. I still think you need to know the basics and how things work and operate. And if in a pinch you need to, right? Because it's pretty scary when somebody doesn't have a piece of equipment. You're just like, hey, I need like 10 pounds of small dice. And they're like, what is a small dice? And then you're just like, oh my God. Okay. Well, yeah, right? Here we go, basic one. And they pick up a knife and it's really scary at how little they know how to use a knife. But all the equipment is speeding things up when you can push buttons. Did you see Rationale's announcement the other day with the iHexagon?
No, I have not seen that one.
Yeah, so I think Unox came out with theirs, I think, last year, but they're now incorporating microwave into the combi. So it's
Speed X.
Convection. Yeah, so, well, they came out with the Speed Pro, which was just basically a Turbo Chef and a convection oven. And we have one that we play with. And then they release one. They're like, now we're adding steam to it. And then Rationale came out with theirs, and now it's supposed to speed up cooking by like 37%, but get the same results, which blew
those
my
ovens
mind.
Are amazing.
Like, I'm like, now you can add microwave, which is going to cook it faster. And they did a really good job, I think, explaining the changes and why they're putting it in. Because I think you've brought it up before that microwaving gets such a bad rap of what they can do. That people hear, oh, there's microwave technology. That's not good. That's not good for my food. I shouldn't be eating it because it came out of a microwave. But it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean,
stuff.
As far as microwaves, I think people are just misled on microwaves. Microwaves are great at heating up food. They're not dangerous. You know, people think because it's a microwave and they can't see the flame or whatever that there's some radiation or something going into the food. But really, it's just heating up the water molecules in the center of the food. It's nothing dangerous. I will say though that it is detrimental to certain food qualities. Like anybody that's had a microwave piece of meat knows it gets rubbery. And it's because of how the radiation hits the water molecules and rapidly forces those protein bonds to like tighten up. They're like protein strands are like rubber bands, and when you stress them too much, they tighten. Well, that's why we gently cook things sous vide. When you sous vide something, you don't have that rapid heat that forces that tightening. Microwaving you do. And speed ovens have been around for, you know, 15, 20 years, probably longer at this point. But that's the problem. Everyone that you've ever used in the past was only good at heating up a piece of bread or a sandwich real quick because everything else got rubbery or dried out. But these Speed X ovens and these Combi Speed ovens that are coming, they're amazing. The fact that when they introduce that steam into the equation and they're not a full steady stream of microwaves, now it's like pulsing microwaves with the Combi action. It's amazing the quality that comes out. No rubber. It's very moist, juicy, and the speed is absolutely unreal. I saw them do a 6-ounce chicken breast from frozen to fully cooked. It wasn't browned, but it was fully cooked in 6 minutes. From fully frozen.
Oh, my God. I mean,
think about that. That's insane. A fresh piece of chicken, 6 ounces, takes about 20 minutes, right? 6 minutes from fully frozen. Like, that's revolutionary to an operation, especially when, you know, speed is the name of the game and you got to turn those tables. So it's neat to see these new technologies coming out. Amazing. But yeah, don't give the microwave a bad rap. I think it has a place in the kitchen. I think it was just marketed poorly, right? It was good for the corporation that was selling them and starting the microwaves. Like, hey, put anything in here and it heats it up. But really, not everything should be put in a microwave. Just kind of understanding the tool, like any of the tools that you have in the kitchen.
For sure. Let's get in the weeds. Do you like to eat eggs?
Love eggs.
What's the best way to eat them?
For me, I like them gently scrambled, double boiler method in a bowl with a little bit of cream cheese or Borzen, whatever you prefer. But that's it. Simple. A little bit of salt. That's my favorite. But I'm going to be honest, I do a fried dippy egg a lot of times, and I do the cream sear on it. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
No.
Put a little bit of cream in the pan.
Okay.
It's a thing that Alex Talbot kind of did on Ideas and Food a bunch with like cream searing things that I saw and I tried it. It's phenomenal. So you put a tiny bit of cream in the pan enough to cover the bottom, crank it up. Crack your eggs in there and let the cream cook out, burn into basically separates into the, you know, solid and the fat.
Right.
And then your egg's done. And it's unreal. The crispiness, the creaminess that cream adds, the rich, deep flavors that you get, it's much better than butter. So try that.
I've been obsessed with eggs as of late. I'm the same way though. I like that soft scramble.
Yeah.
I don't have the time to do double boiler, but yeah, that super creamy, slow cook. And it just like melts in your mouth.
Yeah.
And then I've started adding some avocado to get some other good fats with it. It's just this, I don't know. Every morning it's almost like something to look forward to I don't say as sad as it is, but it's like, I can't wait to eat breakfast today.
There's nothing sad about looking forward to food, man. I think that's one of the best parts of our day. No matter where you are in the world or how bad it is where you are in the world, food is like that thing that makes people happy and brings them together no matter what. So if that's your best part of your day, you're living a good life, right?
I'm waking up on a phenomenal note every day. Next question. What role do you think chefs can play in promoting transparency and ethical practices within their kitchens?
Oh, wow. With the, the advent of social media and, how our career basically lives on social media days nowadays, I think we have a very influential role as chefs because everybody's watching us, not just other chefs. There's, housewives, kids, everybody looks at the culinary industry as this fun and exciting place, an interesting place. I think we got our fame because of the bad things, the Anthony Bourdain book that, peeked behind the curtain and people actually went, whoa, there's a circus going on in kitchens. And yeah, it was cool to kind of like expose that and let people in because it led to this movement of, doing away with that old guard and the yelling and the burning and the screaming and the abuse. That's really what it is. I mean, at the end of the day, if I look back on some of the situations I've been in, as a young line cook, some of the ways I've acted as a sous chef, because that's how I was taught. That's how you, manage your staff. And it's like, it's deplorable. You look on the old ways and how chefs just demeaned people and berated them for kind of enjoyment. It works in high stress, situations to get results out of people. But for the long time, it doesn't work because I just remember teams turning over all the time. Like you get used to a team and it would work, but then people just bounce. And it was because of some instance that didn't need to happen because stress was high and egos were high and people started saying things and doing things they shouldn't have.
Yeah.
And that was acceptable. But nowadays it's not, Yeah, I think people are getting called out on their behavior. I think the people that are notorious for it in the past are now having to, you know, redeem themselves and come clean about how they acted and really show a difference and put programs into place in their operations that keep that from ever happening again. So, you know, out of the bad came the good. Yeah, and I think I chefs are really promoting it now, which is great, you know, to see this like equality and fair treatment in the kitchen is one of the happiest things for me. Cause when I was growing up, I never understood it, you know, why we treated each other that way.
Yeah. I noticed that when I had my first kitchen, I was in my late 20s and just seeing how people acted, I don't know, morally, I was like, why are we being mean to everyone? Why do we want to yell at them? And they found that other chefs in the same position weren't getting the results and everyone was on you're kind of oblivious to it. It's just how I grew up, is to be raised with manners, treat people well. And to be honest, when you're 28 years old, everyone in the kitchen is older than you, or in my case, yes, it was, because I was in higher education. I was like, I got to treat these people with respect. They're my elders. Even though I'm in charge, they're still older than me. And it just worked so well. And we had just, I don't know, we had so much fun. So I was lucky enough to not have to go through a lot of that. I mean, I only had, you know, like a year and a half in. It was still in a corporation, but it wasn't even, it was on a line, but it wasn't near like what some of the restaurants and some of the horror stories we hear, which was nice. And just, you know, treat people nicely. And it's amazing what they'll do for you, how far they'll go for you, how hard they'll work for you. It's amazing.
That's a great point. I mean, I've noticed personally in my career, the kitchens that had that angry, abusive chef, they got stuff done, but not effectively. And everybody kind of operated on fear, not on love for the food. But the kitchens that I worked in, where everybody was accepted and respected, and the chef took on more of a mentor and a teacher role than the, you know, dictator role, those were the kitchens that I just remember singing, right? Like they were happy days. Even though they were busy, stressful days, they were happy days. And the food we made there was beautiful. And everybody enjoyed doing it. You know, it's like we didn't have the call outs every, you know, day with people just being burnt out, not wanting to come to work. Everybody showed up unless they were sick, right? Those are the good kitchens. Count yourself lucky you didn't go through some of the other kitchens. I mean, it makes good chefs, unfortunately, like being treated like that makes you really fast and good at what you do. But it's just, yeah, the traumas and the PTSD and stuff that come with it. I mean, I know I'm affected. Quick side story, the bear.
Yeah.
I actually had to have my wife turn it off because it triggered me on the second or third episode in.
Yeah.
We were watching it where he was on the pass and the chef came up and was like berating him and like talking trash to him while he's trying to get the food out. I've been in that position a couple of times. And when that scene came on, it triggered me. I tell my wife, turn it off. I was like, turn it. And she's like, are you? I'm like, I was shaking white knuckle on my chair because I was there again. And I was getting yelled at by the chef again. And it's like, these things are important to talk about. And I don't think, you know, until recently chefs have really talked about it, but you know, the fact that I can't watch certain TV shows about cooking because, you know, it triggers you, that shows that there was a problem. I'm glad that it's being fixed though.
For sure. On a lighter note, maybe, any cultural fusion cuisine that you've come across recently?
Not so much fusion, but the Indian movement that's going on. I mean, Indian food's been around forever, but like most ethnic cuisines in America, it's been bastardized. What we've been eating as Indian food isn't really what you would get if you went to India. And the Indian culinary landscape is huge, huge. There's so many little micro cuisines within the Indian food landscape that are just brilliant and beautiful and completely different than what you would think of as Indian food that we're used to. But I've noticed like a lot of these micro, you know, very hyper specific Indian cuisines are popping up. These restaurants are popping up left and right. I love it. I love seeing it because the authentic ethnic cuisines that have been coming out over the last couple of years, like Vietnamese, Ethiopian movement happened a few, they build upon us as a culture, right? They make, to me, in my opinion, that's what makes America great on the food scene, is all of these cultures that we have living together and how we can, you know, bring them forward on the plate. And now that we have a better understanding of Indian culture and cuisine coming into our repertoire, I'm expecting to see that kick into menus, you know, like who doesn't go out? You go to a fast casual, your restaurant nowadays, you're going to see something Vietnamese inspired, right? You're gonna see something Mexican inspired. Yeah. Right. And that's what happens. Like these trendy, I hate the term trend, but these cuisines come to the forefront. They become the hot thing for a year or two, and then they get buried in a menu and the next cuisine comes. Yeah. And it's just like this building of understanding of culture. And I think that's awesome. I think that just only exists here.
It goes back to what we talked about, the building the flavors. It's you're yes. now building on cultural, you know, over time, things compound mm-hmm. and just get better and better. I got a topic for you that because you're so forward thinking, I don't get to talk to a lot of people probably about this topic because they don't understand it, but AI. So with recipe development, menu creation, it's gaining traction, or at least I see it. You know, do you see it kind of replacing creativity of the chefs? Do you just see it as an enhancer and a valuable tool for folks in this field?
Yeah. I mean, AI is a scary thing for anybody, at least anybody that grew up with the Terminator, right? Like, why are we messing with AI? Didn't anybody watch the movie? Right? But no, I think AI as we have it now is necessary, right? It's the next evolution in technology, where the computers start thinking and taking over some of that thought for us, so we don't have to think for them so much. I think it was inevitable that it was going to happen, and what I'm seeing it doing for our industry is great, right? I don't think we should be scared of computers taking our jobs as chefs, or machines for that matter. Will machines and computers eliminate redundancies and, you know, lower wage positions of somebody that just stands there, does one task all day long? Yes, that will happen. But what that does for the operation, and what I've seen from my consulting, is when you get the right balance of labor and technology, mm-hmm. you get a better life for the laborer. They get more money, they get more time, they're not as stressed, right? It's a balancing act. We can never get to a point, because of how esoteric and beautiful and amazing the dining experience is for a human, I don't think we'll ever get to a point where a machine can take that over. There are always going to be things that have to have the human touch to have the meaning that we look for in food. So I don't think we're ever going to be replaced. But chefs may now have, you know, normal work schedules, you know. Maybe they'll work 40 hours a week going forward because they don't have to put in 10 hours a day to do the inventory and do the food order and do this and that piece of paperwork that, you know, they don't have time to do ever. So I think it's going to be better for everybody. And we shouldn't push against it. We should adopt it. You know, the AI is natural. It's going to happen. You can push against the ocean so much, but that wave's still coming in to shore, you know. Just learn how to adopt it into your operation so it's not detrimental is, I guess, the only piece of advice I would give. But it's exciting. Yeah. There's some cool stuff coming.
I use it a lot, especially when developing menus, flavor profiles. Again, I don't have a crazy fine dining background, so I haven't had the experiences that a lot of chefs have had. And what AI has allowed me to do is basically take like the flavor Bible and have it at my fingertips. I don't have to flip through and find a protein. Okay, well, what do I want to pair with the protein? And then kind of match those flavor profiles, those spices, sides, etc. I can literally type in, this is the type of event, here's my demographic, this is what I need, and it can spit me out as many or as little options. But the beauty of it is, like you mentioned, we can enhance, because now I, with the knowledge I do have, say, that's just not going to be practical. It may taste good, but I don't think that's practical. Take this and change it to this, and then it can spit you out exactly what it would be. And then from a user experience, what's been great, or I guess clients, is being able, some of the art generative stuff is have the descriptor, it can spit it out and put it into an image, and you don't have to have any of the food waste of, well, here's the plate three different ways and we made it for you. It could be displayed these three different ways. It can literally show you exactly what the plate's going to look like, and they can kind of pick and choose and be like, I like that one and what it did there. Re-render it, and then you can say, this is exactly what your food is going to look like. If you want to now taste it, we'll do a demo for you and cook it, and you can actually taste it. But you have eliminated how many steps and how much time going through trying to get it all figured out with your client. It's so powerful with all the knowledge that's built into it.
Agreed.
So the last thing I got for you, and this is relevant because you being a professor, and it's probably something you do now, but what piece of advice would you give to young culinarians, especially those potentially listening, wanting to get in this field, are in this field?
Well, that's a good one. I get asked that a lot. What would you tell your younger self, or, you know, what piece of advice would you give a younger culinarian? And one thing I always leave every class with on the last day when we're leaving, and I say, you know, you all have your idea of what you want to do with your career, but don't limit yourself by your dream of what you want to do with your career. The world is your oyster nowadays as a professional chef. You can do anything. There's a lot of companies and different disciplines in the, you know, our economy that are looking at the culinary industry and pulling us from it because of the attributes that we as chefs develop in our career. The creativity, the ability to, you know, complete a task fast and efficiently, the ability to consistently repeat as results, you know, the outward thinking, the, you know, wanting to please others and please the customer, like all of these qualities are these companies and corporations are looking at as a huge benefit in an employee. You know, these are attributes that they want. So I tell them, don't put yourself in a box and say to yourself that you're going to go out there and you're going to cook on a line, or I'm going to go out there and be a research chef, because a lot of my students end up being research chefs. And if you are going to do that discipline and that's what you're set on, do the other discipline for a little bit as well. Because if you learn both sides of the coin, it helps you be better at what you're doing. So yeah, just always keep a open mind. And of course, always question everything. Ask why. You know, there's no harm in asking why.
No, most powerful word, in my opinion, just why.
Agreed.
Have a better understanding of what it is. Chef, where do people go? They want to learn more about you, what you're doing, what the company's doing.
Sure. Wearingcommercial.com is our website to check out the company. You can check me out on Instagram. It's probably the best place to find me. I'm at SavageLeeDusty. Or you can check out my email address, dustin.salvaggio@gmail.com. And I'd be happy to have a conversation with you.
Great. Well, we'll link all of those ways to get a hold of you in the show notes. That way, if anyone does, and I can first hand say his Instagram is amazing and he's always got something on there. So if you want to see some really cool stuff, check out the Instagram. I have to say it because ever since I started following you, it's just something. And I'm like, this is really cool stuff.
Stories I put up are, you know, like a full caveat, not everything's food related. I'd like to put up anything that moves me or makes me smile, right? As my stories, and the posts are, you know, just my life. What do I do? You know, where am I? What am I doing? So have fun. Come visit me.
Awesome. So for everyone listening, thank you. We'll catch you on the sunny side, or in this case, maybe, how do you say it, Dustin, with the cream? What is that way?
What do you mean?
The eggs. The eggs.
Oh, cream seared eggs.
Cream. We'll see you with some cream seared eggs. Take care, everybody.
Love it. See ya.
HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.